I don't know, said the demon petulantly. Humans all look alike to me.
Magnus's voice rose, sharp and commanding. Answer me.
Oh, very well. No, I've never seen him before in my life. I'd remember. He looks as if he'd taste good.
The demon grinned, showing razor-sharp teeth.
I haven't even been to this world for, oh, 100 years, possibly more. I can never remember the difference between 100 and 1,000. Anyway, the last time I was here, everyone was living in mud huts and eating bugs, so I doubt he was around.
He pointed a many-jointed finger at Will.
Unless Earthkind lives much longer than I was led to believe.
Magnus rolled his eyes. You're just determined not to be any help at all, aren't you? The demon shrugged, a peculiar human gesture.
You forced me to tell the truth. I told it.
Well then, have you ever heard of a demon like the one I was describing? Will broke in, a tinge of desperation in his voice. Dark blue with a raspy sort of voice, like sandpaper. He had a long, barbed tail. The demon regarded him with a bored expression.
Do you have any idea how many kinds of demons there are in the void, Nephilim? Hundreds upon hundreds of millions. The great demon city of Pandemonium makes your London look like a village. Demons of all shapes and sizes and colors. Some can change their appearance at will.
Oh, be quiet then if you're not going to be of any use, Magnus said, and slammed the book shut. Instantly the candles went out, the demon vanishing with a startled cry, leaving behind only a wisp of foul-smelling smoke. The warlock turned to Will. I was so sure I had the right one this time.
It's not your fault.
Will flung himself onto one of the divans, shoved up against the wall. He felt hot and cold at the same time, his nerves prickling with the disappointment he was trying to force back without much success. He pulled his gloves off restlessly and shoved them into the pockets of his still-buttoned coat.
You're trying. Tammuz was right. I haven't given you very much to go on.
I assume, Magnus said quietly, that you have told me all you remember. You opened a pyxis and released a demon. It cursed you. You want me to find that demon and see if it will remove the curse. And that is all you can tell me.
It is all I can tell you, said Will. It would hardly benefit me to hold anything back unnecessarily when I know what I'm asking. For you to find a needle in... God, not even a haystack. A needle in a tower full of other needles.
Plunge your hand into a tower of needles, said Magnus, and you are likely to cut yourself badly.
Are you really sure this is what you want?
I am sure that the alternative is worse, said Will, staring at the blackened place on the floor where the demon had crouched. He was exhausted. The energy rune he'd given himself that morning before leaving for the council meeting had worn off by noon, and his head throbbed.
I've had 5 years to live with it. The idea of living with it for even one more frightens me more than the idea of death.
You are a shadow hunter. You are not afraid of death.
Of course I am, said Will. Everyone is afraid of death. We may be born of angels, but we have no more knowledge of what comes after death than you do.
Magnus moved closer to him and sat down on the opposite side of the divan. His green, gold eyes shone like a cat's in the dimness. You don't know that there is only oblivion after death.
And you don't know that there isn't, do you?
Jem believes we are all reborn. The life is a wheel. We die, we turn. We are reborn as we deserve to be reborn, based on our doings in this world. Will looked down at his bitten nails.
I will probably be reborn as a slug that someone salts.
The wheel of transmigration, said Magnus.
His lips twitched into a smile.
Well, think of it this way. You must have done something right in your last life to be reborn as you were, Nephilim.
Oh, yes, said Will in a dead tone. I've been very lucky.
He leaned his head back against the divan, exhausted. I take it you'll be needing more ingredients. I think old Mole over at Crossbones is getting sick of the sight of me.
I have other connections, said Magnus,
clearly taking pity on him, and I need to do more research first. If you could tell me the nature of the curse...
No,
Will sat up.
I can't. I told you before, I took a great risk even in telling you of its existence.
If I told you any more,
then what?
Let me guess. You don't know, but you're sure it would be bad. Don't stop making me think coming to you was a mistake. This has something to do with Tessa, doesn't it?
Over the past 5 years, Will had trained himself well not to show emotion. Surprise, affection, hopefulness, joy. He was fairly sure his expression didn't change. But he heard the strain in his voice when he said,
Tessa.
It's been 5 years, said Magnus. Yet somehow, you have managed all this time telling no one. What desperation drove you to me, in the middle of the night, in a rainstorm? What has changed at the Institute? I can think of only one thing, and quite a pretty one, with big, gray eyes.
Will got to his feet so abruptly, he nearly tipped the divan over. There are other things, he said, struggling to keep his voice even. Jem is dying.
Magnus looked at him, a cool, even stare. He has been dying for years, he said. No curse laid on you could cause or repair his condition.
Will realized his hands were shaking. He tightened them into fists.
You don't understand.
I know your parapetai, said Magnus. I know that his death will be a great loss for you. But what I don't know...
You know what you need to know.
Will felt cold all over, though the room was warm, and he still wore his coat.
I can pay you more if it will make you stop asking me questions.
Magnus put his feet up on the divan. Nothing will make me stop asking you questions, he said, but I will do my best to respect your reticence.
Relief loosened Will's hands.
Then you will still help me.
I will still help you.
Magnus put his hands behind his head and leaned back, looking at Will through half-lowered lids. Though I could help you better if you told me the truth. I will do what I can.
You interest me oddly, Will Herondale.
Will shrugged.
That will do well enough as a reason.
When do you plan to try again?
Magnus yawned.
Probably this weekend. I shall send you a message by Saturday if there are developments.
Developments. Curse. Truth. Gem. Dying. Tessa. 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 Her name rang in Will's mind like the chime of a bell. He wondered if any other name on earth had such an inescapable resonance to it. She couldn't have been named something awful, could she, like Mildred? He couldn't imagine lying awake at night, staring up at the ceiling while invisible voices whispered, Mildred, in his ears. But Tessa...
Thank you, he said abruptly.
He had gone from being too cold to being too warm. It was stifling in the room, still smelling of burned candle wax.
I will look forward to hearing from you then.
Yes, do, said Magnus. And he closed his eyes. Will couldn't tell whether he was actually asleep or simply waiting for Will to leave. Either way, it was clearly a hint that he expected Will to depart. Will, not entirely without relief, took it.
Sophie was on her way to Miss Jessamine's room to sweep the ashes and clean the grate of the fireplace when she heard voices in the hall. In her old place of employment, she had been taught to give room, to turn and look at the walls while her employers passed by, and do her best to resemble a piece of furniture, something inanimate that they could ignore. She had been shocked on coming to the Institute to find that things were not managed that way here. First, for such a large house to have so few servants had surprised her. She had not realized at first that the Shadow Hunters did much for themselves that a typical family of good breeding would find beneath them. Started their own fires, did some of their own shopping, kept rooms like the training area and the weapons room cleaned and neat. She had been shocked at the familiarity with which Agatha and Thomas had treated their employers, not realizing that her fellow servants had come from families that had served Shadowhunters through the generations, or that they'd had magic of their own. She herself had come from a poor family, and had been called stupid, and been slapped often when she'd first begun working as a maid, because she hadn't been used to delicate furniture or real silver, or china so thin you could see the darkness of the tea through the sides. But she had learned, and when it had become clear that she was going to be very pretty, she had been promoted to parlor maid. A parlor maid's lot was a precarious one. She was meant to look beautiful for the household, and therefore her salary had begun to go down each year that she'd aged once she had turned 18. It had been such a relief coming to work at the Institute, where no one minded that she was nearly 20, or demanded that she stare at the walls, or cared whether she spoke before she was spoken to, that she had almost thought it worth the mutilation of her pretty face at the hands of her last employer. She still avoided looking at herself in mirrors if she could, but the dreadful horror of loss had faded. Jessamine mocked her for the long scar that disfigured her cheek, but the others seemed not to notice, save Will, who occasionally said something unpleasant, but in an almost perfunctory way, as if it were expected of him that his heart were not in it. But that was all before she had fallen in love with Jem. She recognized his voice now as he came down the hall, raised in laughter, and answering him was Miss Tessa. Sophie felt an odd little pressure against her chest. Jealousy. She despised herself for it, but it could not be stopped. Miss Tessa was always kind to her, and there was such enormous vulnerability in her wide, gray eyes, such a need for a friend, that it was impossible to dislike her, and yet the way Master Jem looked at her, and Tessa did not even seem to notice. No, Sophie just couldn't bear to encounter the two of them in the hall, with Jem looking at Tessa the way he had been lately. Clutching the sweeping brush and bucket to her chest, Sophie opened the nearest door and ducked inside, closing it most of the way behind her. It was, like most of the rooms in the Institute, an unused bedroom, meant for visiting Shadowhunters. She would give the rooms a turn, once a fortnight or so, unless someone was using them, otherwise they stood undisturbed. This one was quite dusty. Motes danced in the light from the windows, and Sophie fought the urge to sneeze as she pressed her eye to the crack in the door. She had been right. It was Jem and Tessa coming toward her down the hall. They appeared entirely engaged with each other. Jem was carrying something. Folded gear, it looked like, and Tessa was laughing at something he had said. She was looking a little down and away from him, and he was gazing at her, the way one did when one felt one was unobserved. He had that look on his face, that look he usually got only when he was playing the violin, as if he were completely caught up and entranced. Her heart hurt. He was so beautiful. She had always thought so. Most people went on about Will, how handsome he was, but she thought that Jem was 1,000 times better looking. He had the ethereal look of angels in paintings, and though she knew that the silvery color of his hair and skin was a result of the medicine he took for his illness, she couldn't help finding it lovely, too. And he was gentle, firm, and kind. The thought of his hands in her hair, stroking it back from her face, made her feel comforted, whereas usually the thought of a man, even a boy, touching her made her feel vulnerable and ill. He had the most careful, beautifully constructed hands. "I can't quite believe they're coming tomorrow," Tessa was saying, turning her gaze back to Jem. "I feel as if Sophie and I are being tossed to Benedict Lightwood to appease him, like a dog with a bone. He can't really mind if we're trained or not. He just wants his sons in the house to bother Charlotte." "That's true," Jem acknowledged. "But why not take advantage of the training when it's offered? That's why Charlotte is trying to encourage Jessamine to take part. As for you, given your talent, even if, I should say when, Mortmain is no longer a threat, there will be others attracted to your power. You might do well to learn how to fend them off. Tessa's hand went to the angel necklace at her throat, a habitual gesture Sophie suspected she was not even aware of. I know what Jessie will say. She'll say the only thing she needs assistance fending off is handsome suitors. Wouldn't she rather have help fending off the unattractive ones? Not if they're mundanes, Tessa grinned. She'd rather an ugly mundane than a handsome shadow hunter any day. That does put me right out of the running, doesn't it? Said Jem with mock chagrin, and Tessa laughed again. It is too bad, she said. Someone as pretty as Jessamine ought to have her pick, but she's so determined that a shadow hunter won't do. You are much prettier, said Jem. Tessa looked at him in surprise, her cheeks coloring. Sophie felt a twist of jealousy in her chest again, though she agreed with Jem. Jessamine was quite traditionally pretty, a pocket Venus, if ever there was one, but her habitual sour expression spoiled her charms. Tessa, though, had a warm appeal, with her rich, dark, waving hair and sea-gray eyes that grew on you the longer you knew her. There was intelligence in her face and humor, which Jessamine did not have, or at least did not display. Jem paused in front of Miss Jessamine's door and knocked upon it. When there was no answer, he shrugged, bent down, and placed a stack of dark fabric, gear, in front of the door. She'll never wear it, Tessa's face dimpled. Jem straightened up. I never agreed to wrestle her into the clothes, just deliver them. He started off down the hallway again, Tessa beside him. I don't know how Charlotte can bear to talk to Brother Enoch so often. He gives me the horrors, she said. Oh, I don't know. I prefer to think that when they're at home, the Silent Brothers are much like us, playing practical jokes in the Silent City, making toasted cheese. I hope they play charades, said Tessa dryly. It would seem to take advantage of their natural talents. Jem burst out laughing, and then they were around the corner and out of sight. Sophie sagged against the door frame. She did not think she had ever made Jem laugh like that. She didn't think anyone had, except for Will. You had to know someone very well to make them laugh like that. She had loved him for such a long time, she thought. How was it that she did not know him at all? With a sigh of resignation, she made ready to depart her hiding place, when the door to Miss Jessamine's room opened and its resident emerged. Sophie shrank back into the dimness. Miss Jessamine was dressed in a long velvet traveling cloak that concealed most of her body, from her neck to her feet. Her hair was bound tightly behind her head, and she carried a gentleman's hat in one hand. Sophie froze in surprise as Jessamine looked down, saw the gear at her feet, and made a face. She kicked it swiftly into the room, giving Sophie a view of her foot, which seemed to be clad in a man's boot, and closed the door soundlessly behind her. Glancing up and down the corridor, she placed the hat on her head, dropped her chin low into the cloak, and slunk off into the shadows, leaving Sophie staring, mystified, after her.
Chapter 3. Unjustifiable Death. Alas, they had been friends in youth, but whispering tongues can poison truth, and constancy lives in realms above, and life is thorny and youth is vain, and to be wroth with one we love doth work like madness in the brain. Samuel Taylor Coleridge. Christabel.
After breakfast the next day, Charlotte instructed Tessa and Sophie to return to their rooms, dress in their newly acquired gear, and meet Jem in the training room, where they would wait for the Lightwood brothers. Jessamine had not come to breakfast, claiming a headache, and Will, likewise, was nowhere to be found. Tessa suspected he was hiding, in an attempt to avoid being forced to be polite to Gabriel Lightwood and his brother. She could only partly blame him. Back in her room, picking up the gear, she felt a flutter of nerves in her stomach. It was so very much unlike anything she'd ever worn before. Sophie was not there to help her with the new clothes. Part of the training, of course, was being able to dress and to familiarize oneself with the gear. Flat-soled shoes, a loose pair of trousers made of thick black material, and a long belted tunic that reached nearly to her knees. They were the same clothes she had seen Charlotte fight in before and had seen illustrated in the Codex. She had thought them strange then, but the act of actually wearing them was even stranger. If Aunt Harriet could have seen her now, Tessa thought, she would likely have fainted. She met Sophie at the foot of the steps that led up to the Institute's training room. Neither she nor the other girl exchanged a word, just encouraging smiles. After a moment, Tessa went first up the steps, a narrow wooden flight with banisters so old that the wood had begun to splinter. It was strange, Tessa thought, going up a flight of stairs and not having to worry about pulling in your skirts or tripping on the hem. Though her body was completely covered, she felt peculiarly naked in her training gear. It helped to have Sophie with her, obviously equally uncomfortable in her own Shadow Hunter gear. When they reached the top of the stairs, Sophie swung the door open, and they made their way into the training room in silence, together. They were obviously at the top of the Institute, in a room adjacent to the attic, Tessa thought, and nearly twice the size. The floor was polished wood, with various patterns drawn here and there in black ink, circles and squares, some of them numbered. Long, flexible ropes hung from great raftered beams overhead, half invisible in the shadows. Witchlight torches burned along the walls, interspersed with hanging weapons, maces and axes and all sorts of other deadly-looking objects. "Ugh," said Sophie, looking at them with a shudder. "Don't they look too horrible by half?" "I actually recognize a few from the Codex," said Tessa, pointing. "That one there's a longsword, and there's a rapier, and a fencing foil, and that one, that looks like you'd need two hands to hold it, is a claymore, I think." "Close," came a voice, very disconcertingly from above their heads. "It's an executioner's sword, mostly for decapitations. You can tell because it doesn't have a sharp point." Sophie gave a little yelp of surprise and backed up as one of the dangling ropes began to sway and a dark shape appeared over their heads. It was Jem, clambering down the rope with the graceful agility of a bird. He landed lightly in front of them and smiled. "My apologies. I didn't mean to startle you." He was dressed in gear as well, though instead of a tunic, he wore a shirt that reached only to his waist. A single leather strap went across his chest, and the hilt of a sword protruded from behind one shoulder. The darkness of the gear made his skin look even paler, his hair and eyes more silver than ever. "Yes, you did," said Tessa with a little smile. "But it's all right. I was beginning to worry Sophie and I were going to be left here to train each other." "Oh, the Lightwoods will be here," said Jem. "They're simply being late to make a point. They don't have to do what we say, or what their father says either." "I wish you were the one training us," Tessa said impulsively. Jem looked surprised. "I couldn't. I haven't completed my own training yet." But their eyes met, and in another moment of wordless communication, Tessa heard what he was really saying. "I'm not well enough, often enough, to train you reliably." Her throat hurt suddenly, and she locked eyes with Jem, hoping he could read her silent sympathy in them. She did not want to look away, and found herself wondering if the way that she had scraped her hair back, carefully pinning it into a bun from which no stray strands escaped, looked horribly unflattering. Not that it mattered, of course. It was just Jem, after all.
"We won't be going through a full course of training, will we?" Sophie said, her worried voice breaking into Tessa's thoughts. "The Council only said that we needed to know how to defend ourselves a bit."
Jem looked away from Tessa. The connection broke with a snap. "There's nothing to be frightened of, Sophie," he said in his gentle voice. "And you'll be glad of it. It's always useful for a beautiful girl to be able to fend off the unwanted attentions of gentlemen." Sophie's face tightened. the livid scar on her cheek, standing out as red as if it had been painted there.
"Don't make fun," she said. "It isn't kind."
Jem looked startled.
"Sophie, I wasn't."
The door to the training room opened. Tessa turned as Gabriel Lightwood strode into the room, followed by a boy she didn't know. Where Gabriel was slender and dark-haired, the other boy was muscular, with thick, sandy blonde hair. They were both dressed in gear, with expensive-looking dark gloves studded with metal across the knuckles. Each wore silver bands around each wrist. Knife sheaths, Tessa knew, and had the same elaborate white pattern of runes woven into their sleeves. It was clear not just from the similarity of their clothes, but from the shape of their faces and the pale, luminous green of their eyes that they were related. So Tessa was not in the least surprised when Gabriel said, in his abrupt manner,
"Well, we're here as we said we would be. James, I assume you remember my brother, Gideon. Miss Gray, Miss Collins. Pleased to make your acquaintance,"
Gideon muttered, meeting neither of their eyes with his. Bad moods seemed to run in the family, Tessa thought, remembering that Will had said that next to his brother, Gabriel seemed a sweetheart.
"Don't worry, Will's not here,"
Jem said to Gabriel, who was glancing around the room. Gabriel frowned at him, but Jem had already turned to Gideon.
"When did you get back from Madrid?"
he asked politely.
"Father called me back home a short while ago."
Gideon's tone was neutral.
"Family business. I do hope everything's all right."
"Everything is quite all right, thank you, James,"
said Gabriel, his tone clipped.
"Now, before we move to the training portion of this visit, there are two people you should probably meet."
He turned his head and called out,
"Mr. Tanner, Miss Daly, please come up."
There were footfalls on the steps, and two strangers entered, neither in gear. Both wore servants' clothes. One was a young woman who was the very definition of raw-boned. Her bones seemed too big for her skinny, awkward frame. Her hair was a bright scarlet, drawn back into a chignon under a modest hat. Her bare hands were red and scrubbed-looking. Tessa guessed she was about 20. Beside her stood a young man with dark brown curling hair, tall and muscular. Sophie took a sharp indrawn breath. She had gone pale.
"Thomas?"
The young man looked terribly awkward.
"I'm Thomas's brother, miss. Cyril. Cyril Tanner."
"These are the replacements the council promised you for your lost servants,"
said Gabriel.
"Cyril Tanner and Bridget Daly. The consul asked us if we would bring them from King's Cross here, and naturally we obliged. Cyril will replace Thomas, and Bridget will replace your lost cook, Agatha. They were both trained in fine Shadowhunter households, and come soundly recommended."
Red spots had begun to burn on Sophie's cheeks. Before she could say anything, Jem said quickly,
"No one could replace Agatha or Thomas for us, Gabriel. They were friends as well as servants."
He nodded toward Bridget and Cyril.
"No offense intended."
Bridget only blinked her brown eyes, but...
"None taken," said Cyril.
Even his voice was like Thomas's, almost eerily so.
"Thomas was my brother. No one can replace him for me either."
An awkward silence descended on the room. Gideon leaned back against one of the walls, his arms crossed, a slight scowl on his face. He was quite good-looking, like his brother, Tessa thought, but the scowl rather spoiled it.
"Very well," Gabriel said finally into the silence. "Charlotte had asked us to bring them up so you could meet them. Jem, if you'd like to escort them back to the drawing room, Charlotte's waiting with instructions."
"So neither of them needs any extra training,"
Jem said.
"Since you'll be training Tessa and Sophie regardless, if Bridget or Cyril..." "As the consul said, they have been quite effectively trained in their previous households,"
said Gideon.
"Would you like a demonstration?"
"I don't think that's necessary,"
Jem said. Gabriel grinned.
"Come along, Carstairs. The girls might as well see that a mundane can fight almost like a shadow hunter,
with the right kind of instruction. Cyril?
He stalked over to the wall, selected two long swords and threw one toward Cyril, who caught it out of the air handedly, and advanced toward the center of the room, where a circle was painted on the floorboards.
He already knew that,
muttered Sophie in a voice low enough that only Tessa could hear.
Thomas and Agatha were both trained. Gabriel is only trying to annoy you, said Tessa, also in a whisper. Do not let him see that he bothers you.
Sophie set her jaw as Gabriel and Cyril met in the center of the room, swords flashing. Tessa had to admit there was something rather beautiful about it. The way they circled each other, blades singing through the air, a blur of black and silver. The ringing sound of metal on metal, the way they moved, so fast her vision could barely follow. And yet, Gabriel was better, and that was clear even to the untrained eye. His reflexes were faster, his movements more graceful. It was not a fair fight. Cyril, his hair pasted to his forehead with sweat, was clearly giving everything he had, while Gabriel was simply marking time. In the end, when Gabriel swiftly disarmed Cyril with a neat flicking motion of his wrist, sending the other boy's sword rattling to the floor, Tessa couldn't help but feel almost indignant on Cyril's behalf. No human could beat a shadow hunter. Wasn't that the point? The point of Gabriel's blade rested an inch from Cyril's throat. Cyril raised his hands in surrender, a smile, much like his brother's easy grin, spreading across his face. I yield. There was a blur of movement. Gabriel yelped and went down, his sword skittering from his hand. His body hit the ground, Bridget kneeling atop his chest, her teeth bared. She had slipped up behind him and tripped him while no one was looking. Now she whipped a small dagger from the inside of her bodice and held it against his throat. Gabriel looked up at her for a moment, dazed, blinking his green eyes. Then he began to laugh. Tessa liked him more in that moment than she ever had before. Not that that was saying much.
Very impressive, drawled a familiar voice from the doorway.
Tessa turned. It was Will, looking, as her aunt would have said, as if he'd been dragged through a hedge backward. His shirt was torn, his hair was mussed, and his blue eyes were rimmed with red. He bent down, picked up Gabriel's fallen sword, and leveled it in Bridget's direction with an amused expression.
But can she cook?
Bridget scrambled to her feet, her cheeks flushing dark red. She was looking at Will the way girls always did, a little open-mouthed, as if she couldn't quite believe the vision that had materialized in front of her. Tessa wanted to tell her that Will looked better when less bedraggled, and that being fascinated by his beauty was like being fascinated by a razor-sharp piece of steel. Dangerous and unwise. But what was the point? She'd learn it herself soon enough.
I am a fine cook, sir,
she said in a lilting Irish accent.
My previous employers had no complaints.
Lord, you're Irish, said Will. Can you make things that don't have potatoes in them? We had an Irish cook once when I was a boy. Potato pie, potato custard, potatoes with potato sauce.
Bridget looked baffled. Meanwhile, somehow, Jem had crossed the room and seized Will's arm.
Charlotte wants to see Cyril and Bridget in the drawing room. Shall we show them where it is?
Will wavered. He was looking at Tessa now. She swallowed against her dry throat. He looked as if there was something he wanted to say to her. Gabriel, glancing between them, smirked. Will's eyes darkened and he turned, Jem's hand guiding him toward the stairway, and stalked out. After a startled moment, Bridget and Cyril followed. When Tessa turned back to the center of the room, she saw that Gabriel had taken one of the blades and handed it to his brother.
Now,
he said.
It's about time to start training, wouldn't you say, ladies?
Gideon took the blade.
Esta es la idea más estúpida que nuestro padre ha tenido, he said.
Nunca.
Sophie and Tessa exchanged a look. Tessa wasn't sure exactly what Gideon had said, but Estúpida sounded familiar enough. It was going to be a long remainder of the day. They spent the next few hours performing balancing and blocking exercises. Gabriel took it upon himself to oversee Tessa's instruction, while Gideon was assigned to Sophie. Tessa couldn't help but feel that Gabriel had chosen her to annoy Will in some obscure way, whether Will knew about it or not. He wasn't a bad teacher, actually. Fairly patient, willing to pick up weapons again and again as she dropped them, until he could show her how to get the grip correct, even praising when she did something right. She was concentrating too fiercely to notice whether Gideon was as adept at training Sophie, though Tessa heard him muttering in Spanish from time to time. By the time the training was over and Tessa had bathed and dressed for dinner, she was starving in a most unladylike manner. Fortunately, despite Will's fears, Bridget could cook, and very well. She served a hot roast with vegetables and a jam tart with custard to Henry, Will, Tessa, and Jem for dinner. Jessamine was still in her room with a headache, and Charlotte had gone to the Bone City to look directly through the reparations archives herself. It was odd, having Sophie and Cyril coming in and out of the dining room with platters of food, Cyril carving the roast, just as Thomas would have, Sophie helping him silently. Tessa could hardly help but think how difficult it had to be for Sophie, whose closest companions in the Institute had been Agatha and Thomas. But every time Tessa tried to catch the other girl's eye, Sophie looked away. Tessa remembered the look on Sophie's face the last time Jem had been ill, the way she'd twisted her cap in her hands, begging for news of him. Tessa had ached to talk to Sophie about it afterward, but knew she never could. Romances between mundanes and shadowhunters were forbidden. Will's mother was a mundane, and his father had been forced to leave the Shadowhunters to be with her. He must have been terribly in love to be willing to do it. And Tessa had never had the sense that Jem was fond of Sophie in that way at all. And then there was the matter of his illness.
"Tessa," Jem said in a low voice, "are you all right? You look a million miles away."
She smiled at him. "Just tired. The training, I'm not used to it." It was the truth. Her arms were sore from holding the heavy practice sword, and though she and Sophie had done little beyond balancing and blocking exercises, her legs ached too.
"There's a salve the Silent Brothers make for sore muscles. Knock on the door of my room before you go to sleep and I'll give you some."
Tessa flushed slightly, then wondered why she had flushed. The Shadowhunters had their odd ways. She had been in Jem's room before, even alone with him. Even alone with him in her night attire, and no fuss had been made over it. All he was doing now was offering her a bit of medicine. And yet she could feel the heat rise in her face. And he seemed to see it, and flushed himself, the color very visible against his pale skin. Tessa looked away hastily, and caught Will watching them both, his blue eyes level and dark. Only Henry, chasing mushy peas around his plate with a fork, seemed oblivious.
"Much obliged," she said. "I will..."
Charlotte burst into the room, her dark hair escaping from its pins in a whirl of curls, a long scroll of paper clutched in her hand.
"I've found it," she cried.
She collapsed breathlessly into the seat beside Henry, her normally pale face rosy with exertion. She smiled at Jem.
"You were quite right. The reparations archives. I found it after only a few hours of looking."
"Let me see," said Will, setting down his fork.
He had eaten only a very little of his food, Tessa couldn't help noticing. The bird design ring flashed on his fingers as he reached for the scroll in Charlotte's hand. She swatted his hand away good-naturedly.
"No, we shall all look at them at the same time. It was Jem's idea anyway, wasn't it?"
Will frowned but said nothing. Charlotte spread the scroll out over the table, pushing aside teacups and empty plates to make room, and the others rose and crowded around her, gazing down at the document. The paper was really more like thick parchment, with dark red ink,
like the color of the runes on the Silent Brothers' robes. The handwriting was in English, but cramped and full of abbreviations. Tessa could make neither head nor tail of what she was looking at. Jem leaned in close to her, his arm brushing hers, reading over her shoulder. His expression was thoughtful. She turned her head toward him. A lock of his pale hair tickled her face.
"What does it say?" she whispered.
"It's a request for recompense," said Will, ignoring the fact that she had addressed her question to Jem. "Sent to the York Institute in 1825 in the name of Axel Hollingworth Mortmain, seeking reparations for the unjustified death of his parents, John Thaddeus and Anne Evelyn Shade, almost a decade before."
"John Thaddeus Shade?" said Tessa. "J.T.S., the initials on Mortmain's watch. But if he was their son, why doesn't he have the same surname?"
"The Shades were warlocks," said Jem, reading farther down the page. "Both of them. He couldn't have been their blood son. They must have adopted him and let him keep his mundane name. It does happen from time to time."
His eyes flicked toward Tessa, and then away. She wondered if he was remembering, as she was, their conversation in the music room about the fact that warlocks could not have children.
"He said he began to learn about the dark arts during his travels," said Charlotte. "But if his parents were warlocks..."
"Adoptive parents," said Will. "Yes, I'm sure he knew just who in Downworld to contact to learn the darker arts."
"Unjustifiable death," Tessa said in a small voice. "What does that mean exactly?"
"It means... he believes that Shadow Hunters killed his parents, despite the fact that they had broken no laws," said Charlotte.
"What laws were they meant to have broken?" Charlotte frowned.
"It says something here about unnatural and illegal dealings with demons. That could be nearly anything. And that they stood accused of creating a weapon that could destroy Shadow Hunters. The sentence for that would have been death. This was before the Accords, though, you must remember. Shadow Hunters could kill Downworlders on the mere suspicion of wrongdoing. That's probably why there's nothing more substantive or detailed in the paperwork here. Mortmain filed for recompense through the York Institute under the aegis of Aloysius Starkweather. He was asking not for money, but for the guilty parties, Shadow Hunters, to be tried and punished. But the trial was refused here in London on the grounds that the Shades were beyond a doubt guilty. And that's really all there is. This is simply a short record of the event, not the full papers. Those would still be in the York Institute."
Charlotte pushed her damp hair back from her forehead.
"And yet, it would explain Mortmain's hatred of Shadow Hunters. You were correct, Tessa. It is personal. And it gives us a starting point, the York Institute," said Henry, looking up from his plate. The Starkweathers run it, don't they? They'll have the full letters. Papers? And Aloysius Starkweather is 89, said Charlotte. He would have been a young man when the Shades were killed. He may remember something of what transpired.
She sighed.
I'd better send him a message. Oh dear, this will be awkward. Why is that, darling?
Henry asked in his gentle, absent way.
He and my father were friends once, but then they had a falling out. Some dreadful thing absolutely ages ago, but they never spoke again.
What's that poem again?
Will, who had been twirling his empty teacup around his fingers, stood up straight and declaimed,
"Each spake words of high disdain and insult to his heart's best brother."
"Oh, by the angel, Will, do be quiet," said Charlotte, standing up. "I must go and write a letter to Aloysius Starkweather that drips remorse and pleading. I don't need you distracting me."
And, gathering up her skirts, she hurried from the room.
"No appreciation for the arts," Will murmured, setting his teacup down.
He looked up, and Tessa realized she had been staring at him. She knew the poem, of course. It was Coleridge, one of her favorites. There was more to it as well, about love and death and madness. But she could not bring the lines to mind, not now, with Will's blue eyes on her.
"And, of course, Charlotte hasn't eaten a bit of dinner," Henry said, getting up. "Ah, I'll go see if Bridget can make her up a plate of cold chicken, as for the rest of you."
He paused for a moment, as if he were about to give them an order. Send them to bed, perhaps, or back to the library to do more research. The moment passed, and a look of puzzlement crossed his face.
"Blast it, I can't remember what I was going to say," he announced,
and vanished into the kitchen. The moment Henry left, Will and Jem fell into an earnest discussion of reparations, downworlders, accords, covenants, and laws that left Tessa's head spinning. Quietly, she rose and left the table, making her way to the library. Despite its immense size, and the fact that barely any of the books that lined its walls were in English, it was her favorite room in the Institute. There was something about the smell of books, the ink and paper and leather scent, the way dust in a library seemed to behave differently from the dust in any other room. It was golden in the light of the witch-light tapers, settling like pollen across the polished surfaces of the long tables. Church the cat was asleep on a high bookstand, his tail curled round above his head. Tessa gave him a wide berth as she moved toward the small poetry section along the lower right-hand wall. Church adored Jem, but had been known to bite others, often with very little warning. She found the book she was looking for, and knelt down beside the bookcase, flipping until she found the right page. The scene where the old man in Christabel realizes that the girl standing before him is the daughter of his once best friend and now most hated enemy. The man he can never forget. Alas, they had been friends in youth, but whispering tongues can poison truth. And constancy lives in realms above. And life is thorny, and youth is vain. And to be wroth with one we love doth work like madness in the brain. Each spake words of high disdain and insult to his heart's best brother. They parted, ne'er to meet again. The voice that spoke above her head was as light as it was drawling, instantly familiar. "Checking my quotation for accuracy?" The book slid out of Tessa's hands and hit the floor. She rose to her feet and watched, frozen, as Will bent to pick it up and held it out to her, his manner one of utmost politeness. "I assure you," he told her, "my recall is perfect." So is mine, she thought. This was the first time she had been alone with him in weeks. Not since that awful scene on the roof, when he had intimated that he thought her little better than a prostitute, and a barren one at that. They had never mentioned the moment to each other again. They had gone on as if everything were normal, polite to each other in company, never alone together. Somehow, when they were with other people, she was able to push it to the back of her mind, forget it. But faced with Will, just Will, beautiful as always, the collar of his shirt open to show the black marks twining his collarbone, and rising up the white skin of his throat. The flickering taper light glancing off the elegant planes and angles of his face. The memory of her shame and anger rose up in her throat, choking off her words. He glanced down at his hand, still holding the little green leather-bound volume. "Are you going to take Coleridge back from me? Or shall I just stand here forever in this rather foolish position?" Silently, Tessa reached out and took the book from him. "If you wish to use the library," she said, preparing to depart, "you most certainly may. I found what I was looking for, and as it grows late..." "Tessa," he said, holding out a hand to stop her. She looked at him, wishing she could ask him to go back to calling her Miss Gray. Just the way he said her name undid her, loosened something tight and knotted underneath her ribcage, making her breathless. She wished he wouldn't use her Christian name, but knew how ridiculous it would sound if she made the request. It would certainly spoil all her work training herself to be indifferent to him.
Yes?
She asked. There was a little wistfulness in his expression as he looked at her. It was all she could do not to stare.
Will wistful?
He had to be play-acting.
Nothing.
I...
He shook his head. A lock of dark hair fell over his forehead, and he pushed it out of his eyes impatiently.
Nothing,
he said again.
The first time I showed you the library, you told me your favorite book was The Wide, Wide World. I thought you might want to know that I... read it.
His head was down, his blue eyes looking up at her through those thick, dark lashes. She wondered how many times he'd gotten whatever he wanted just by doing that. She made her voice polite and distant.
And did you find it to your liking?
Not at all, said Will. Drivelly and sentimental, I thought.
Well, there's no accounting for taste, Tessa said sweetly, knowing he was trying to goad her and refusing to take the bait. What is one person's pleasure is another's poison, don't you find?
Was it her imagination, or did he look disappointed?
Have you any other American recommendations for me?
Why would you want one when you scorn my taste? I think you may have to accept that we are quite far apart on the matter of reading material, as we are on so many things, and find your recommendations elsewhere, Mr. Herondale. She bit her tongue almost as soon as the words were out of her mouth. That had been too much, she knew. And indeed, Will was on it, like a spider leaping onto a particularly tasty fly.
Mr. Herondale, he demanded. Tessa, I thought...
You thought what?
Her tone was glacial.
That we could at least talk about books.
We did, she said. You insulted my taste. And you should know, The Wide, Wide World is not my favorite book. It is simply a story I enjoyed, like The Hidden Hand or... You know, perhaps you should suggest something to me, so I can judge your taste. It's hardly fair otherwise.
Will hopped up onto the nearest table and sat, swinging his legs, obviously giving the question some thought.
The Castle of Otranto.
Isn't that the book in which the hero's son is crushed to death by a gigantic helmet that falls from the sky? And you said A Tale of Two Cities was silly? Said Tessa, who would have died rather than admit she had read Otranto and loved it.
A Tale of Two Cities? Echoed Will. I read it again, you know, because we had talked about it. You were right. It isn't silly at all.
No?
No, he said. There is too much of despair in it.
She met his gaze. His eyes were as blue as lakes. She felt as if she were falling into them.
Despair?
Steadily, he said.
There is no future for Sidney, is there, with or without love? He knows he cannot save himself without Lucy, but to let her near him would be to degrade her.
She shook her head. That is not how I recall it. His sacrifice is noble.
It is what is left to him, said Will.
Do you not recall what he says to Lucy?
If it had been possible that you could have returned the love of the man you see before yourself, flung away, wasted, drunken, poor creature of misuse as you know him to be, he would have been conscious this day and hour, in spite of his happiness, that he would bring you to misery, bring you to sorrow and repentance, blight you, disgrace you, pull you down with him.
A log fell in the fireplace, sending up a shower of sparks, and startling them both, and silencing Will. Tessa's heart leaped, and she tore her eyes away from Will.
Stupid, she told herself angrily. So stupid.
She remembered how he had treated her, the things he had said, and now she was letting her knees turn to jelly at the drop of a line from Dickens.
Well, she said, you have certainly memorized a great deal of it. That was impressive.
Will pulled aside the neck of his shirt,
revealing the graceful curve of his collarbone. It took her a moment to realize he was showing her a mark a few inches above his heart.
"Mnemosyne," he said. "The memory rune. It's permanent."
Tessa looked away quickly. "It is late. I must retire. I am exhausted." She stepped past him and moved toward the door. She wondered if he looked hurt, then pushed the thought from her mind. This was Will. However mercurial and passing his moods, however charming he was when he was in a good one, he was poison for her, for anyone.
"Vatek," he said, sliding off the table.
She paused in the doorway, realizing she was still clutching the Coleridge book, but then decided she might as well take it. It would be a pleasant diversion from the Codex. "What was that?"
"Vatek," he said again. "By William Beckford. If you found Otranto to your liking," though she thought she had not admitted she did, "I think you will enjoy it."
"Oh," she said. "Well, thank you. I will remember that." He did not answer. He was still standing where she had left him, near the table. He was looking at the ground, his dark hair hiding his face. A little bit of her heart softened, and before she could stop herself, she said, "And good night, Will." He looked up.
"Good night, Tessa."
He sounded wistful again, but not as bleak as he had before. He reached out to stroke Church, who had slept through their entire conversation, and the sound of the falling log in the fireplace, and was still stretched out on the bookstand, paws in the air. "Will," Tessa began, but it was too late. Church made a yowling noise at being woken, and lashed out with his claws. Will began to swear. Tessa left, unable to hide the slightest of smiles as she went.
Chapter 4 A Journey. Friendship is one mind in two bodies. Meng Zhu.
Charlotte slammed the paper down onto her desk with an exclamation of rage.
"Aloysius Starkweather is the most stubborn, hypocritical, obstinate, degenerate—"
She broke off, clearly fighting for control of her temper. Tessa had never seen Charlotte's mouth so firmly set into a hard line.
"Would you like a thesaurus?"
Will inquired. He was sprawled in one of the wing-back armchairs near the fireplace in the drawing room, his boots up on the ottoman. They were caked with mud, and now so was the ottoman. Normally Charlotte would have been taking him to task for it, but the letter from Aloysius that she had received that morning, and that she had called them all into the drawing room to discuss, seemed to have absorbed all her attention.
"You seem to be running out of words."
"And is he really degenerate?"
Jem asked, equably from the depths of the other armchair.
"I mean, the old codger's almost 90.
Surely past real deviancy?" "I don't know," said Will. "You'd be surprised at what some of the old fellows over at the Devil Tavern get up to."
"Nothing anyone you know might get up to would surprise us, Will," said Jessamine, who was lying on the chaise, a damp cloth over her forehead.
She still had not gotten over her headache.
"Darling,"
said Henry anxiously, coming around the desk to where his wife was sitting.
"Are you quite all right? You look a bit splotchy."
He wasn't wrong. Red patches of rage had broken out over Charlotte's face and throat.
"I think it's charming," said Will. "I've heard polka dots are the last word in fashion this season."
Henry patted Charlotte's shoulder anxiously.
"Would you like a cool cloth? What can I do to help?"
"You could ride up to Yorkshire and chop that old goat's head off."
Charlotte sounded mutinous.
"Won't that make things rather awkward with the clave?"
asked Henry.
"They're not generally very receptive about, you know, beheadings and things."
"Oh,"
said Charlotte in despair.
"It's all my fault, isn't it?
I don't know why I thought I could win him over. The man's a nightmare.
What did he say exactly? Said Will. In the letter, I mean.
He refuses to see me, or Henry, said Charlotte. He says he'll never forgive my family for what my father did. My father, she sighed. He was a difficult man. Absolutely faithful to the letter of the law, and the Starkweathers have always interpreted the law more loosely. My father thought they lived wild up there in the north, like savages, and he wasn't shy about saying so. I don't know what else he did, but old Aloysius seems personally insulted still. Not to mention that he also said if I really cared what he thought about anything, I would have invited him to the last council meeting, as if I'm in charge of that sort of thing.
Why wasn't he invited? Inquired Jem.
He's too old. Not meant to be running an institute at all. He just refuses to step down. And so far, Consul Wayland hasn't made him. But the Consul won't invite him to councils either. I think he hopes Aloysius will either take the hint or simply die of old age. But Aloysius's father lived to be 104. We could be in for another 15 years of him.
Charlotte shook her head in despair.
"Well, if he won't see you or Henry, can't you send someone else?"
asked Jessamine in a bored voice.
"You run the Institute. The Enclave members are supposed to do whatever you say."
"But so many of them are on Benedict's side," said Charlotte. "They want to see me fail. I just don't know who I can trust."
"You can trust us," said Will. "Send me and Jem."
"What about me?"
said Jessamine indignantly.
"What about you? You don't really want to go, do you?"
Jessamine lifted a corner of the damp cloth off her eyes to glare.
"On some smelly train all the way up to deadly dull Yorkshire? No, of course not. I just wanted Charlotte to say she could trust me."
"I can trust you, Jessie, but you're clearly not well enough to go, which is unfortunate, since Aloysius always had a weakness for a pretty face."
"Even more reason why I should go," said Will.
"Will, Jem,"
Charlotte bit her lip.
"Are you sure? The council was hardly best pleased by the independent actions you took in the matter of Mrs. Dark."
"Well, they ought to be. We killed a dangerous demon," Will protested.
"And we saved church," said Jem.
"Somehow I doubt that counts in our favour," said Will. "My cat bit me 3 times the other night."
"That probably does count in your favour," said Tessa. "Or Jem's, at least." Will made a face at her, but didn't seem angry. It was the sort of face he might have made at Jem, had the other boy mock insulted him. Perhaps they really could be civil to each other, Tessa thought. He had been quite kind to her in the library the night before last.
"It seems a fool's errand," said Charlotte.
The red splotches on her skin were beginning to fade, but she looked miserable.
"He isn't likely to tell you anything if he knows I sent you. If only..."
"Charlotte," Tessa said, "there is a way we could make him tell us." Charlotte looked at her in puzzlement.
"Tessa, what do you..."
She broke off then, light dawning in her eyes.
"Oh, I see. Tessa, what an excellent idea." "Oh, what?"
demanded Jessamine from the chaise.
"What idea?"
"If something of his could be retrieved," said Tessa, "and given to me, I could use it to change into him, and perhaps access his memories. I could tell you what he recollects about Mortmain and the Shades, if anything at all."
"Then you'll come with us to Yorkshire," said Jem.
Suddenly all eyes in the room were on Tessa. Thoroughly startled, for a moment she said nothing.
"She hardly needs to accompany us," said Will. "We can retrieve an object and bring it back to her here."
But Tessa said before that she needs to use something that has strong associations for the wearer, said Jem. If what we select turns out to be insufficient...
She also said she can use a nail clipping or a strand of hair.
So you're suggesting we take the train up to York, meet a 90-year-old man, leap on him, and yank out his hair? I'm sure the Clave will be ecstatic.
They'll just say you're mad, said Jessamine. They already think it, so what's the difference, really?
It's up to Tessa, said Charlotte. It's her power you're asking to use. It should be her decision.
Did you say we'd be taking the train? Tessa asked, looking over at Jem. He nodded, his silver eyes dancing.
The Great Northern runs trains out of King's Cross all day long, he said. It's only a matter of hours.
Then I'll come, said Tessa. I've never been on a train.
Will threw up his hands. That's it? You're coming because you've never been on a train before?
Yes, she said, knowing how much her calm demeanor drove him mad.
I should like to ride in one. Very much.
Trains are great, dirty, smoky things, said Will. You won't like it.
Tessa was unmoved.
I won't know if I like it until I try it, will I?
I've never swum naked in the Thames, but I know I wouldn't like it.
But think how entertaining for sightseers, said Tessa. And she saw Jem duck his head to hide the quick flash of his grin. Anyway, it doesn't matter. I wish to go, and I shall. When do we leave?
Will rolled his eyes, but Jem was still grinning.
Tomorrow morning. That way we'll arrive well before dark.